When white Europeans first came to this continent, they began seizing land and forcing native inhabitants out. Maybe they didn't think of it as theft. But if the same thing happened today, we would not hesitate to call it stealing, and we would want whatever was taken returned. Land Back is a movement that demands exactly that, the return of native lands to native people. That could mean handing over property rights, or it could mean restoring stewardship of ancestral territories, or redistributing wealth back to indigenous communities, or all of the above. Land Back is a growing movement in the U.S. and even more so in Canada. Charles Monroe Kane reached out to one of its leaders, Hayden King. He's the executive director of the Yellowhead Institute and Anishinaabe from Beausoleil First Nation in Ontario.
You know, land has a legal meaning. It's about ownership. It also has cultural and historic meanings. What does land mean to you?
I try to refer back to Anishinaabe thought and philosophy and importantly language when I'm thinking about land. And, you know, the English language sort of trains you to think about land as this static concept and almost as a commodity, something that you own or something that you buy or sell or something that you extract resources from. But in our language, Anishinaabemowin, the word for land is commonly referred to as aki or aki, but the root of that is actually akina. And you talk to elders and they do the translation work and they say that the closest literal translation to that is everything in unity. And so when you think about land on those terms as this unifying force, as the thing that binds us all and connects us all, then you start thinking in land in different terms. In a lot of indigenous languages and philosophies and indigenous law, certainly Anishinaabe law, land is something that is alive and has agency and certainly must be respected. And that includes respecting maybe even the sovereignty and self-determination of land. So that's how I like to think about land. But, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that that takes work, right? This is sort of part of the decolonizing that we all need to do in our relationship to land.
You know, when you read about the Land Back movement, you find a bunch of word associations. You just brought one up. Decolonization, there's also reparations, reconciliation. It seems like land back is a lot more than just, you know, giving land back.
Yeah, I mean, probably the single loudest demand among Indigenous people since the relationship to settlers emerged was this demand for land back from land theft and from dispossession. And I think that that's entirely valid. We want to get land back. Almost universally, that's what Indigenous people will say. But land back is also a lot more than that. It's also about revitalizing Indigenous life. Because if we're thinking about land as everything in unity, and we're thinking about our languages connected to the land, and our culture connected to the land, and our family and social organizations connected to the land, then land back is this broader movement towards revitalizing Indigenous life.
I want to ask a question, and I don't mean it to be so elementary you're going to scoff at it or to be even painful for you. But I think we need to remind people, like, this was your land. How did you lose it?
The language that I might use is, you know, how is it taken away as opposed to lost?
No, yeah, that's better. Okay.
You know, it's clear that the discussion is a lot about words that we use. And I think that this is an important one because the sort of principal institution between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada and the United States is the treaty. And in the Canadian context, treaties were made around the time of Confederation. So they're very much these nation-building tools that allowed for the settlement of the country. And I think that it's not that dissimilar in the United States, though I think in Canada, sort of treaties were made prior to settlement. In the United States, treaties were made sort of after settlement. But as these nation-building tools, really, in retrospect, they were, you know, vehicles of dispossession in in many ways. And as states and provinces and territories sort of legitimized their rule, Indigenous perspectives were marginalized. And that sort of hoped for collaborative relationship disappeared. And states started working towards eliminating the political threat that Indigenous peoples presented to those states and provinces and entire countries. And so that meant things like assimilation policies and Indian wars and residential schools, industrial schools, boarding schools. And then this very long period of suppression of indigenous political difference. So in a lot of ways, what you're seeing now with the revitalization of the land back movement, this is, you know, a century coming. It's not necessarily that we're asking the Canadian government for the land back and the Canadian government is, you know, sure, we'll give you the land back. It's more of confronting state power, police, resource companies, corporations, putting our bodies in the path of bulldozers. I mean, you saw it at Standing Rock. In a lot of ways, that forces confrontation, but it also forces negotiation.
I read your report and a bunch of stuff online as I got really into it. There's been a lot of success. I was reading about the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement and the other one I cannot pronounce, but it's the Tsilhuntin Nation versus British Columbia in 2014. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't those claims give sovereignty to the land?
Yeah, those are two really different examples. So
okay,
in the Nunavut case, the Inuit in the far north of Canada approached the government and said, listen, we've never created a treaty with you. You're illegally squatting on our land. So let's create a treaty and figure out what our relationship is to one another. And in that case, the federal government had been compelled by a court decision to make treaties where there were no treaties, because as the courts effectively agreed with Indigenous people in Canada that where there are no treaties, people are illegally squatting. They didn't say it in those terms, but
yeah,
effectively they agreed with that perspective. And so Canada was forced to make new treaties. Now, one of the core elements of the modern treaty process and the example like Nunavut is that the Indigenous community has to do what's called extinguishing title or surrendering their rights and title to land in exchange for the treaty. So they have to give up 90% of the land to keep 10% of the land. Or in the Nunavut case, they got to keep 18% of the land, but they had to surrender 82% of the land. So it's not exactly an equal distribution of land in these new treaties.
Yeah, it doesn't sound equal. Right.
So in the Chilcotin case, the other case that you're referencing, this community in the province of British Columbia decided they weren't interested in surrendering their title. So they decided instead, we want to keep that title and we're going to fight Canada all the way to the Supreme Court so that we get our title recognized to our land. And that's what they did. And they were, by and large, successful. And so the Chilcotin, they charted a completely different path than the Inuit and Nunavut. I think there's positive and negatives, I suppose you could say, with each of those approaches. But that's an ongoing debate.
It's fascinating. You know, when I was a kid, my family lived in Alaska. I had a brief stay over, you know, a week, 2 weeks in Wood Buffalo National Park. There was an activist. Young activist. He was in an interview. And just as an aside, he said, the least they could do was give us the national parks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the parks. What about having them being turned over?
You know, the history of the park system in the United States and Canada is a pretty violent one. Some of the first parks in the United States, you know, Yosemite and Yellowstone, were created under this belief that people were separate from nature and were separate from wildlife. So the indigenous people that lived in these places where parks were proposed to be created, they had to be relocated, right? They had to be removed. And so in Canada, the first provincial park in the province that I live, Ontario, is called Quetico Provincial Park. And the government forced indigenous people in those parks to leave. And in fact, one of the communities that they forced to leave was declared extinct 20 years later. And so now there is, I think, a latent movement towards talking about co-managing some of those lands. There's a park in Labrador, a park in Northwest Territories, where Indigenous people have significant involvement in how those parks are managed. But if you're asking me if I think handing over these parks to Indigenous peoples exclusively and having the management of those spaces is a good idea, I think that yes, absolutely it is. And I think practically, if you're interested in the land back movement from like a policy, a legal perspective, are you going to go to private landowners and tell them they have to give their land back to Indigenous people? Or maybe are you going to look at some of these vast areas of federal lands that could be transferred to Indigenous people and have those folks manage them? I think that that's a wonderful idea and I support it wholeheartedly.
Okay. There's a lot of things in the courts. There's a lot of things spinning around. If I'm looking at the map of Canada, what would change if the land back movement was successful?
you know, the vision of Indigenous people, or at least the Anishinaabeg people, has always been looking at the land as the sort of basket or a bowl. And we all live in that bowl and we share the spoon and we pass it to one another and we eat from it together. And so there's nothing in Anishinaabeg perspective about living on the land with other people that has to be exclusive. And sometimes we can get stuck in that when we look at maps. You know, this is one jurisdiction's territory and this is another jurisdiction's territory. But moving towards an Indigenous approach to our relationship to the land might mean that the map has many layers.
Right.
It has those layers of provinces and territories, but it also has those layers of, you know, Anishinaabeg governance of the Great Lakes. And that exists. There's lines on lines on lines.
Right. And maps can be three-dimensional.
Yeah, I think through time and space, absolutely. And it's less about who owns the land, and it's more about how you relate to the land.
I have a final question for you. And this is an uncomfortable question, I think, for someone in your position. Do you have hope? Mm. Are you going to get your land back? Is it going to work out?
Yeah. I mean, I will always have hope in Indigenous youth who are leading this movement and Indigenous communities that are really paving the way. And I feel light when I talk about language revitalization with my ancestors or I go hunting.
Uh-huh.
So absolutely that gives me hope. And, you know, you get drawn into the fights that we have with resource companies and state governments, and it can certainly take you into a dark place and question your neighbors and your friends. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, I think Indigenous people are leading and showing the way. And for me, that's hopeful.
Hayden King is Anishinaabe from Beausoleil First Nation in Chinmising in Ontario. He's the executive director of the Yellowhead Institute and co-author of the seminal Yellowhead Red Paper, Land Back. And if you'd like to know whose land you're on, check out the online map created by the folks at Native Land Digital. You can search it by zip code or address, so it's a really great place to begin. To find out more, visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is made each week by a tiny team of audio producers. Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angelo Bautista, Mark Rickers, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and me, Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening, and come back often. Thank you.